Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for Thursday, July 15th. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, joined by managing editor Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
Ben Philpott, who's back with us this week.
Hello, I am back with you this week.
And Brandy Grissom, who is sitting in for a vacationing Evan. Hey, Brandy.
Hello.
We're talking this week about campaign finance reports that are due after this recording, but due this week. Education, the controversy over the Texas projection measure, the immigration issue and whether it's a tricky issue for Governor Rick Perry, and Brandy's border series on El Paso. So let's go ahead and start with campaign finance. Set this up for us. By the time some folks listen to this, the numbers may be out.
Yeah, we should start getting numbers here pretty quick. This is the mid-year report. It's the numbers reporting what they have raised, spent, borrowed, and have on hand through June 30th. So the candidates already know this, and they've been spending 2 weeks getting their accountants and everything lined up and figuring out what their spin's going to be. The first race we're all going to be looking at, of course, is the governor's race to see both how much Rick Perry and Bill White raised, and more importantly, going forward, how much money they have in the can. Now, the Perry campaign is downplaying this a little bit, trying to lay out the idea that, well, you know, we had a primary and he really didn't have a primary where we had to spend a lot of money. So Bill White might have more money than we do. So,
but you know,
they're trying to set an expectation. Right. That could be a deal where they're anticipating having less money. It could be a deal where they're trying to set everybody up to think they're going to have less money. And then when they have more money, it outperforms the expectation that they themselves set. It's all kind of a game at this point. But basically, we're looking at war chests. And then as you go down the ballot, there's some interesting things going along. Everybody expects David Dewhurst, who is personally rich, to show that he's politically rich as well. Linda Chavez Thompson to have a little bit less money. And then when we get into legislative races, part of it's going to be how much candidates themselves have, and part of it's going to be about how much various PACs that are important in legislative races have. So the Associated Republicans of Texas has already said, we've got 1,000,001. And the Texans for Lawsuit Reform got reported, told somebody, I think the American Statesman, that they had $2.7 million on hand, which is about what they always have. But those PACs are starting to line up. And we're basically getting, you know, this is the, this will be the most recent look at how everybody's suited up financially for the elections in November.
So what is some of the down ballot stuff? I mean, further down, like State House, there was an email from, and of course I don't remember the person's name, the opponent for Patrick Rose.
Jason Isaac, right.
Showing $169,000. Does that mean something?
This is an interesting deal. Patrick Rose is a Democrat. He's in Hays County, Dripping Springs, which is just south of Austin, southwest of Austin. And it's been a swing district for a long time. It's been a district that, you know, on any given day, a Democrat could beat a Republican or vice versa. Rose is one of the most accomplished fundraisers in the Texas legislature and has something over $2 million in the bank. So Republican House Speaker Joe Strauss went down and did a fundraiser for Democrat Patrick Rose and got some of the Republicans kind of worked up about it. And the backstory, not directly from Strauss, but from people close to Strauss, was, well, you know, it's not really a race. And now Jason Isaac has come forward with $170,000 that he raised, so maybe this is a serious Republican candidate. Now, we're told from Isaac's folks that Strauss has said he won't do any more fundraisers down there, and kumbaya, kumbaya, let's all back out carefully and slowly. But that looks like that could be a race. So, you know, in races like that, that's where the money, you know, where you see, you look at a race on paper and you say, I don't think that's a real race. And then you look at it and see the money and you go, oh, well, that changes my mind. There's going to be races where that we think are real big races where we look at them and say, oh, that changes my mind. There's no money there. So,
of course, on the flip side, we all remember that money doesn't buy elections, i.e. Tony Sanchez or something. I mean, a lot of money has been spent on races, or a lot of money has come out on paper, which still right. hasn't mattered in the end. So right. I'm just fascinated kind of by the money, what this really matters.
Well, money's about what you can do with money. Right. You know, you're trying to get votes, and you're trying to get people off their couches to go vote. And so they've got to know your candidate's name, and they have to have a reason to go do that. And the money is the way to market the candidate in an ideal world, you know, in a textbook world. You know, this is candidate X, and she's for XYZ, and you're for XYZ, so you should vote for candidate X. And that's the purpose of the money, is to get people to the polls. It's possible to win an election with no money if everybody knows you and they agree with what you want, but it's not usually the case.
Right. And on the flip side, it's possible to lose an election with a whole lot of money
Tony
if
Sanchez,
you don't use it correctly.
Right.
Let's switch over to a big topic, an issue topic this week, which Ben is going to tee up for us about the Texas projection measure.
Yeah, the Texas projection measure is just a new thing they threw in this year to the state accountability system, which essentially graded student performance based on whether or not this projection measure thinks they would pass the tax test in the future. So they didn't pass, some of them didn't pass different areas, but because they did a little bit better in other areas, it was projected that they would pass in the future, or they would at least do better in the future. And these projections have allowed hundreds and even thousands of schools to move up one category from unacceptable to acceptable, which is very huge, but even recognized to exemplary. You know, it's just caused a lot of controversy. You've got politicos who say, well, this is great. Now the education system looks perfect for Governor Perry in a reelection year. You've got others that have taken a more pragmatic approach to it, like the Texas Association of Business, who came out, I don't know, 6-8 months ago with a bunch of Hispanic and even Center for Public Policy Priorities, which some people think's a liberal think tank, or may call it the liberal think tank. Right. They don't. But anyway.
They prefer progressive.
They prefer progressive. But, you know, saying, look, this measure is not helping the accountability system. It's not actually showing what's going on. It's providing a crutch. It's, you know, Bill Hammond's been on the accountability system for a while anyway.
I mean, this is the president of Texas Association of Business.
His whole thing is, look, you know, we need a good workforce, and we're not going to get a good workforce by pretending to have a better education system. So anyway, a lot of people were mad about it. Robert Scott came out and said, well, you know, hey, if we don't like it, maybe we can get rid of it. But, you know, I was talking to different people in different kind of levels of education around the state, and classroom teachers or administrators or whatever. And you know, it's some people feel like the accountability system in general before this was not measuring progress correctly. It was not, there was no wiggle room for a school or a student is improving. So stop, you know, crucifying the school when progress is being made. Now, maybe this measure isn't the best way to do that.
Well, the question here is whether you're going to measure growth or whether you're going to measure a forecast of growth. I mean, it's whether the student has grown or the student will grow. You know, if you were the Houston Astros right now, you'd love to be graded on a performance measure that says you're going to get better later, because right now you stink. You know, this thing, it has a couple of there looks like there's a couple of places where people have criticized it. One of them is that it's a projection. It's sort of, you know, pulled out of your ear, and it's actually possible for a student who has gone backwards to have a projection that's positive. And then the second thing is that the projection, the benefits of this only accrue to the school districts for measuring the school districts in accountability. The student who was flunking is still flunking.
He still has to retake the test and everything.
Well, the grade inflation doesn't work for the student. It works for the school.
Has there been anything about what will happen with these new accountability rankings if they take out this performance measure? Will we see a whole bunch of schools come out a lot lower in the next
rankings? Well, you
could.
And what's really interesting is because of the changeover from the current accountability system tax to STAR, which is the next round of accountability that the state passed a year ago, when they do the next round of rankings, which will be July of 2011, that'll be the last tax ranking. And if they take the performance measure out, you could see a lot lower. And then that ranking stays in place for 2 years because there's a 2-year waiting period for STAR to kick in. So you could have a school that should go from recognized to acceptable or acceptable to unacceptable next year, and then they would have to sit there for 2 years with that ranking without a chance to make it better.
You know, what's at stake for some of the schools here is that if the school's in the tank for a certain period of time, then the feds and the state both, you know, jump in and intervene. And it can be as much as, you know, let's fire the whole staff and replace it. Let's, you know, reconstitute the school, or, you know, let's close it. You know, there's a bunch of measures that can be taken there. And if these numbers go backwards like that and throw a bunch of schools back in the tank, and then those numbers persist for a couple of years.
You trickle down even further. Local school districts that have, you know, borderline rankings are always constantly negotiating with local real estate agents to say, look, would you please stop telling everyone don't move into our district? I mean, you know, and then it's the kind of the self-fulfilling prophecy. If upperly mobile families decide to leave the district because of school rankings, the school is left with people that have less resources within their own lives, and they then have to supply more resources to get them up to speed at school. And it goes on and on and on.
So one of the other side political flashpoints is that in Ross alluded to this growth versus potential growth problem. That's essentially why the Bill White campaign called this Enron-style accounting, because Enron essentially, instead of actual profits, they
booked future profits.
Projected profits. And so, but then, you know, him calling it Enron ended up being kind of controversial too. So,
well, and you know,
it does give him a bit of an opening though.
But you know, I talked to one person who's in school accountability and said, so, you know, what about this whole idea that it's a campaign issue, that it's, you know, making schools look good for Governor Perry in a reelection year? And they told me, well, of course the ratings go up in an election year.
Right, so it's just expected. Well, that's very cynical, and we're not saying that. Ben's random anonymous neighbor said
but
that.
But this is a political issue. I mean, you know, this is, you know, whenever an issue like this presents in a political year, it's going to be fodder. And if, you know, if part of the discussion is already high dropout rates, which it is, I mean, they've been talking about this all along. Kay Hutchison talked about it before that. Tony Sanchez talked about it before that. You know, if that's part of the issue and the quality of education is part of the issue, then inflating the grades of schools so that the schools will look better has got to be part of the political discussion.
Right. And Perry is now touting a new education initiative. So this week he rolls out or is proposing a business tax credit for businesses who help
their employees get their GEDs.
Right. And so is this then going to become an issue that carries us through the fall? I don't know. How long are people going to stay outraged about the TPM?
I think – I don't know about – TPM, but you know, education in general will get people madder than anything, and longer, you know, stay madder longer than just about anything. I think maybe immigration. I don't know. But
well, you're assuming that they're mad about the TPM now. They're not really even lit up on this yet.
I mean, it's only Scott Hochberg. No.
Well, you know, you know, these things, you know, they sort of present themselves as, you know, headlines or as legislative hearings or however, you know, these start series of columns in the Houston Chronicle. You know, however they work. And they either catch or don't. The campaigns will be, you know, and probably already are, but the campaigns will be polling and seeing if this works. And if you say dropouts and TPM all in one sentence, does that work? And, you know, they'll be trying everything.
Well, you know,
what we'll see by September, October is the stuff that they think works.
The commercial is, under Governor Perry, your local high school is rated exemplary. But did you know 1/3 of your students dropped out between 9th grade and 12th grade year?
And then the flip from the Perry campaign, at least so far, has been, you know, you're just running Texas down. Why are you doing that?
Well,
and, you know, we'll see which message works.
All right.
Because Bill White hates Texas, right? I mean,
I heard that, yeah. There's the phone call. That's Katie Bacon dialing right now.
We're just kidding.
I'm going to switch to my topic now. I'm actually sticking to the election, actually, or the gubernatorial race. This week, Governor Perry was on Neil Cavuto's show on Fox Business and was asked, his first question was whether the recent poll number showing Perry and White at 43-43, which we've questioned here on this Tribcast anyway, but whether the race was tightening as a result of Perry's immigration positions. And this, as a flashpoint in the race, is very interesting to me because Perry has continued to defend, even in the primary, financial aid for children of illegal immigrants in college in Texas, and then has come out to say that he did not support the Arizona immigration law. When he was asked again by Cavuto why he didn't support it, he said, well, all different, or I guess he was asked why Texas wasn't going to adopt it or something like that, and Perry said, you know, all states are different, which wasn't much of an answer. So to what extent is this a tricky issue for him this fall?
Well, you know, this has been a tricky issue all along. This starts as a tricky issue for Southwestern Republican governors with Pete Wilson in California. And you know, his troubles with the immigration issue in California, and the argument in California is that the way he handled that lost the California all the statewide offices for the Republicans. So George Bush was careful about this, you know, coming out of all of that. And Rick Perry's been very careful and has mostly talked about border security as opposed to immigration. And to the extent that he's talked about immigration, much of it's been about the federal government's failure to police the borders. And he's kind of left it there. Now, Arizona takes a proactive, you know, whatever you think of the Arizona law, it's a proactive approach to immigration. You know, you need to act in this way and do these things. And people who have made immigration like a key issue, and they want to stop the flow of illegal immigrants into the United States, have locked on this and said, okay, this is a place where we draw a line. Everybody, including Perry, has sort of been in the business of not drawing a line. Let's talk about border security. Let's talk about the safety of places like El Paso, which border Ciudad Juarez, where they're having a terrible drug war. Brandy could talk about that in great detail. And the issue for Perry is border security, and he'd like to keep it there. When you put the Arizona law in front of him and say, you know, what do you think about this? He says, well, you know, these are all local issues, and you have to treat them differently. It's not really a new line, and I'm not sure that it hurts him. You know, because he can flip right back and start talking about border security again.
And I think some people would argue, at the Republican convention this year, they had that long debate about how tough the language should be on immigration, and there are lots of people who say that the party, with some of the rhetoric, could be shooting themselves in the foot with the, as we all know, ever-growing Hispanic population in the state. So I think it might hurt Perry more to come out with the hardline stance. I mean, he's already the Tea Party favorite. He's already the ultra-conservative favorite. It's not like he needs to be tough on immigration to make sure that he seals up the Republican base. So
he's not facing a challenge from the right.
It's not like Bill White's going to want to adopt that law, probably.
Well, that's exactly right. And if you go all the way over, if you're Rick Perry and you go all the way over to the Arizona law and say, you know, that's exactly what I want in the state of Texas, then you just opened a door for Bill White.
Right.
And so,
who hates Texas?
Right. Which is different than what's going on for John McCain in Arizona, because, you know, in Arizona, John McCain is having to go farther and farther away from his original centrist positions on immigration and go farther and farther right because his challenger
is
more conservative than him. In this case, in this general election, who's more conservative than Perry, who's running for governor? I don't know a whole lot about Catherine Glass. I don't know what her position is, but, you know, I'm guessing she's not calling for the Arizona immigration law because she's a libertarian, but
I'm not advised.
Okay. All right, let's switch over with our final few minutes and have Brandy kind of tee up the series that's running in the Tribune this week, which we hope you read.
Well, it's a three-part series, and what I did was took some time to go down to three different communities on the Texas-Mexico border and really try to get an idea of what life is like on both sides of the Rio Grande in those areas and how the drug violence there is impacting residents' lives on both sides. And in my trips, some very different things stood out to me in each of the places that I went to. So I went first to El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. And one of the things that stood out to me, which you'll see in the story today, is sort of the economic difference between those two cities and how, as the violence in Juarez has really spiraled out of control, the economy there has also spiraled sort of down the drain. But at the same time, all of that has been going on in El Paso. The economy there has been prospering, and it's partly a result, in large part, to some of the developments that have been happening there for decades to try to build up the city. But it's also a result, to some degree, of people from Juarez fleeing north to El Paso, opening up new nightclubs, new restaurants, and really bringing a whole new nightlife to El Paso that people who live there long complain never existed, bring new jobs and those kinds of things. So I thought that was sort of an interesting and sort of sad dichotomy that, you know, El Paso was prospering, at least in some degree, as their sister city was really suffering. And then I next stopped in Fort Hancock, which is just across the border from El Porvenir in the Valle de Juarez. And that region of Mexico has seen an unbelievable amount of violence, especially in comparison to the population. It's a very rural area where most of the folks were alfalfa and cotton farmers or worked in factories in Juarez. And a lot of people also would have been for a long time involved in the drug trade. And so that's why the violence there has really has escalated to an unbelievable degree. There have been something like more than 75 deaths there just this year, and the population in those small towns is less than 20,000. So it's an unbelievable death rate. People's homes have been burned. The cartels there have told people to leave town or face death. It's a really, really scary place, and we actually spent some time there being scared. And And so got a real sense of the place. But then right across the border in Fort Hancock, which is in Hudspeth County, also a very, very small, very rural community, they're sort of seeing all this new law enforcement rush into their community to make sure that that violence doesn't spill over. And so just sort of the difference in how the security level is and the fear levels among the residents there, I thought was really sort of fascinating. And so the story sort of explores the fear and the level of security on both sides of the border there. And then the final story, which will run Friday, talks about the small towns of Ojinaga and Presidio. And those are over near Big Bend. Presidio is just south of Marfa. And those towns for a long time have been really poor, really isolated. And a lot of the reason that they've been poor and isolated for so long are the same reasons that right now they're one of the most peaceful areas along the border, because they're isolated and they're desolate and no one wants to go there. So not
even
only
the drug cartels.
Yeah. Right. The businesses, drug cartels, nobody wants to go there. And so the fear is that while it's peaceful now, as the violence starts to escalate in these other towns and cities around them, that the cartels may feel like they're forced into this area that has been peaceful for so long.
So this is the other side of the Arizona coin. So you get this,
right?
So this is where you talk about border security and issues like that on one hand, and, you know, if you're Perry, you rail against Washington's failure to, hold the line on this stuff.
Invade Mexico.
Right.
Let us secede.
You know, and if you're running in against an incumbent, these are signs of failure. These are signs of, so this is part of the political discussion, too. I was looking for something a minute ago that sort of plays into this. The Hispanic Federation and LULAC did a study of Latino public opinion that just came out on the day that we're recording this. And it talks about how galvanizing for the Latino vote the Arizona law is. And so if you're Rick Perry and Bill White, and to the extent that you're playing for Latino votes, Perry's said openly, I wanted to improve the Republican numbers here. I want to improve the percentages. White has said conversely that, we need Latino votes to win. Linda Chavez Thompson's making a special thing of it. She's the lieutenant governor candidate on the Democratic side. So I think when you talk about, when you talk about the Arizona thing, when you talk about the border security issues and how these twin cities are doing and other cities that are similarly situated are doing, I think that's all part of this bigger political discussion that's going to close in November with, how the Latinos vote.
And it's fascinating because El Paso County, we've looked at numbers on this since we have them all, but El Paso County and Collin County, my home county, are about the same size, but the turnout in Collin County is so much stronger that if turnout in El Paso County matched turnout in Collin County, then the state would be a bluer state, much bluer state.
Right.
And so I guess holding or staying neutral as Perry is on Arizona is the smartest thing for
and then
to
it's
do
Bill,
in order to keep.
And it's Bill White's job to remind everyone in El Paso how close Arizona is to them. Right.
Well, that's right.
I mean, and say it could happen here next. Right. Right. Don't listen to Perry. It could happen here next. So you better vote for me. I mean,
that's part of what we're going
to
be listening to over
and over
again.
Too much convincing in El Paso,
right.
though.
Right. Yeah. Well, we're going to be listening to this a lot. I guess between now and November, this is going to be part of the game.
Right. And between now and November, Evan will be back. At some point, he will be back to join us on the Tribcast. But for now, on behalf of Ross, Ben, and Brandy, I'm Elise. Thank you for listening.